listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 38 is, how do mathematical concepts like number relate to the real world? We read Bertrand Russell's book from 1919, Introduction to Mathematical Philosophy, chapters 1 through 3 and 13 through 18. Read along with us at partiallyexaminedlife.com. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer, existing in a series of discrete time segments in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Allwyn, Bang, Theory of Types in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Josh Pelton, an individual member of a set of inhabitants of Long Island, New York.
All right, so we are without a Seth today. It's Team West today. And Josh, why are you here, Josh?
I'm here because I'm masquerading as some sort of expert or person who is knowledgeable about mathematics. For some reason, these guys think that mechanical engineer has some sort of insight into what numbers are.
Let me clarify. We don't necessarily, for our guests, find experts. We find people who are interested. That's our only expertise in some of these areas.
Oh, well, I'm an absolute expert in being interested about things.
And Josh is known for his calculation skills.
Oh, yeah. I did crunch some numbers for you. Let me see if I can find the paper.
So, yes, on an internet forum, which is how I originally met Josh, he was answering questions like, how much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? And coming up with reasonable sounding bases for the various factors that would go into calculating that.
It was something in between 20 and 60 chords per minute, I believe.
So we'll try to provide a link to that particular explanation.
Applied mathematics.
I gave you a challenge earlier today, so you'd have to work under pressure. I just was trying to think of something that would have some quantitative questions. So my idea was Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind.
I did run some calcs for that, and the answers in order are 0, 0, 0, around 362 to 9,666 years, 122 years, 164 days, infinity, 1, 1, and 0. It's actually pretty easy. I mean, most of the stuff is like, how many roads must a man walk down if somebody's
Before
going to call him a man? You can call him a man. He doesn't have to walk down anything, really. I mean.
What was the question for the large number there? How many years must a people exist before? Is that?
No, it was how many years can a mountain exist before it's washed away into the sea or something like that? And so I went ahead and found like an upper and a lower range for sea erosion rates on the coast and compared it to Everest. And so if Everest was on the coast, it would take anywhere from 362 years to around 10,000 years for it to wash away.
So there is Josh's utility, which will undoubtedly be useful in decoding this.
Utility is kind of is not the word that I would use to describe it.
It's a brilliant lack of utility of the type.
Absolutely. I'll go with that.
Of the type that Wes consistently advocates.
Yes.
The only background that you might need to have for this episode, which reminds me that we should do the rules, but in one second, is Bertrand Russell is the guy we most recently talked about in our Frege episode just a couple back. So if you really want to understand everything that's going on here, go back and listen to the Frege episode. But as usual, we will attempt to explain what needs explaining when it comes up. But let's do the rules. Josh, I thought you had some alternate version of at least one of the rules.
I do have alternate versions for two of the rules. You guys are going to have to remind me of the third one. In the Russell style, first rule for the class of Partially Examined Life podcasters and guest P, and the class of all philosophical knowledge S, for any X in P and any Y in S, the statement Y presupposes knowledge of S is always false. And for any philosopher N in the class of philosophers A, the statement X name drops N is always false.
Yes. So once again, we have someone presenting the rule and violating it at the same time, because we are assuming that the audience can make sense.
Oh, and that's the one that I forgot, is that we're not going to assume that they actually read the text.
That's actually just part of the...
Oh, it's a subset?
We're trying not to assume, yes, exactly, that our audience has read what we're talking about, or has any other background in philosophy, the name-dropping thing. For instance, do you have an example?
For name-dropping, well, if you had just read the entirety of Gödel's incompleteness theorem proof, then you would understand why this works.
That's right. And number three, we will be rigorous and exact in all that we say, except when doing so would be offensively tedious.
Well, considering that we just read Russell and he's kind of set the bar for what rigor is, I think that
and tedium.
We may have to appeal to the tedium rule or tedium exception.
Really? Did you object? I thought this was for a mathematics text. Okay, so I know people, for instance, Seth, who is not here today, not because he is totally offended by the topic, but for scheduling reasons. But actually, I thought he was not going to be around for this, and so I scheduled this topic then on purpose, because this is one that he expressed less enthusiasm for. I would assume a lot of our listenership is probably similarly math phobic, or at least does not find it interesting enough. But this, the thing that back into school days that I didn't like about math was just the repetitive nature of the calculations. But all the conceptual stuff I liked, and this is all conceptual, so I had no problem with this.
It's actually interesting. I just finished reading sort of a rant from a mathematics professor at Cornell or MIT or something. I can't really remember where he's from, but he was saying how we don't really teach mathematics in school. We teach just this by rote calculation of crap, really. Why do I care what this angle is? Why should I care what X is? What am I solving for? They just teach you to push around symbols and stuff, and they don't really give you any conception of math is supposed to be a joyous exploration of ideas and sort of the realm of pure thought and such. So he was kind of ranting about how nobody ever really did any mathematics until they got to college, and it's only then when they really realized that it was something that you could enjoy.
Which is exactly when I stopped taking math.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you study calculus, and I remember, because I was in such a good student in high school, but I didn't know what it meant, really. And I didn't explore what it meant. Then I went to a college where we studied calculus by reading Newton's Principia, which is basically he's developing it as he's applying it, and then sort of getting at the philosophy of it.
Did you have to read it in Latin?
No, that would be, it's already brutal.
That would be impressive. I would have to give you props for that.
And you had to read Euclid and stuff. So as part of a well-rounded, great books sort of education, as was given at St. John's, your undergrad, that we so often talk about.
So yeah, but I do remember as an elementary school student learning my times tables and wondering what the set theoretic foundations of it all were.
Apparently that was attempted. I was listening to some other podcast, a recent episode on the new math. In the, I guess, early 70s, that was a bunch of mathematics professors deciding that they should actually teach grade school kids set theory and things. And that the result of that was them not understanding the complex stuff and not learning the basics either. And so it was a wash.
Yeah, it's kind of hilarious. Every 20 years or so, some high-level mathematics professors get this bright idea to teach third and fourth graders some not super advanced theory, but just a different kind of curriculum, a different way of teaching them the math curriculum. And my mother was actually part of one of those experiments, and she still has trouble to this day because she was taught how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide in base 8. Instead of base 10.
Oh my God.
So she'll regularly go to the supermarket and is like, oh, this is $1.20. And, 50% off. And she says, oh, that's 40 cents. No.
Yes, Mom. There exists a base such that what you're saying is true. But
yeah.
Really, if you teach, one of the big differences is teaching people how to prove things in mathematics is much different than teaching them what you're generally taught, because it's a much different mindset. So it's one of the things I got at St. John's. You're given a proposition and you're asked to prove it, whether it's in geometry or something else. And then at the University of Texas, I TA'd for, I think you had to do this too, Mark, right? For the logic and set theory class, the symbolic logic class, where I became pretty adept at doing any of the symbolic logic proofs because I had to teach it to the students and grade their proofs.
I did that, but I can't say I retained any of it.
Yeah, can't say how much I've retained either. But I do remember getting to the point where I was reading people's proofs like they were English practically, just like gliding through them.
Yeah, that's a pleasurable part of the math-related field. However, there's still the question of, even if reading about especially high-level math is interesting in itself, what is the philosophical point? Mathematics professors sort of, for the most part, seem to see this as a self-contained, pure land of numbers, or numbers and related expressions. And so what's the point? And I don't know if Russell and Frege here are giving us a philosophical point, but at least they're relating it to something else, right? So there are the logicists that we talked about on the Frege episode, his Begriffsschrift, his attempt to ground all proofs in math systematically by reducing the moves in math to moves in logic. So math becomes one special case of logic.
Yeah, and I know that Russell talks a little bit about how it's been sort of a gradual convergent evolution of logic and mathematics. Mathematics is logic, and that there's no real differentiation to be made between the two.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it begins with Leibniz historically. I mean, arguably, you could go back farther.
Yeah, I think this is actually a really awesome quote on 195. He says, "Mathematics is the manhood of logic." He's a mathematician, so I'm certain that there are some logicians that would have the reverse opinion about that.
And I guess he points out that they have very different historical origins, that logic is typically seen, I guess, as an abstraction from thought. It's more or less how people think, and we already talked about in the Frank episode how he was against that psychologism of logic. That's, no, it's not how people actually think at all. It's normative rules for how we should think. Whereas with math, we go way back to Pythagoras and other folks that are thinking of numbers as some part of a realm of entities more perfect than those that we encounter in our experience. They are not abstractions. And of course, Plato spent some time among the Pythagoreans. And so the thing that he is notorious for, his otherworldly world of forms, is really a generalization of this Pythagorean view of numbers, that there's not only the perfect numbers, but there's the perfect justice and everything else. So that alone justifies studying the philosophy of math. However, I was a little hard put to come up with what the question is for this, because even though my question was, how do mathematical concepts like number relate to the real world? Russell, he's giving an answer to that in reducing math to logic. Logic is supposed to be in some way more ordinary. And he seems to think that logic is abstracted from real things we encounter. And in fact, one of the main points in the chapters that we discuss is how the concept of number itself is supposed to refer to, in an indirect way, to real things in the world. So, you know, if we lived in a world with no real things or with only four real things, that would produce problems for this theory of numbers. But at the same time, he doesn't really focus on that ontological question very directly, at least very much in here.
He leaves it open right in the end. The ontological status of sets, right, he refuses to affirm or deny.
He talks a little bit about Leibniz's view and how Leibniz's proofs about the nature of mathematics and reality and stuff. He's assuming that there's no such thing as a true identity. You can have one thing, but there can be no other thing that's exactly that thing. And Russell pulls a standard mathematician. He just says, well, of course, there can be two things that are exactly the same thing, just not in our reality. You have to think more generally than the real world.
Yes. So we're going to get only an abstruse, if any, answer to the question that I posed, but I wasn't sure what other philosophical question is being directly addressed. And the real reason for reading this, let's just give the little background. So this is a shortened version. This Introduction to Mathematical Philosophy is an easy-to-read version explicitly for people with no facility for symbolic language, I think is what he says about it. Version of his more famous Principia Mathematica that he wrote with Albert North Whitehead. That's the famous book. And I was never forced to read any portion of that or really even read much about that in graduate school, and felt like in our quest for thoroughness, given how influential it was, I wanted to take a look at it in some way. And this seemed the most painless way to do it. This was, I think, a great training for, I mean, if you do want to read sort of advanced stuff in analytic philosophy, a whole group of people, Carnap is another example that comes to mind, a guy we've talked about once or twice on this podcast, that I think if you're not using symbolic logic in your philosophy articles, you are not being serious. You're not doing real philosophy.
Yeah.
So there's a whole chapter in here that's really just a text-heavy and symbol-light introduction to symbolic logic. You know, the and the or symbol and the if-then symbol are for all that. We tried a little bit to explain this on the Frege podcast, and I have had some blog posts about it. So I think it's a really painless way to be introduced to that. And not only does he introduce these things, but then he uses them pretty immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like again and again and again in different proofs, that kind of remembering by use repetition. But he tries to derive some substantial conclusions out of it. It's not just, here are the symbols, and now you know how to make nice-looking truth tables or something like that, and you still don't know why the fuck you would ever want to do that. Or at the very least, we can say, oh, well, when you're writing your arguments, to really prove to somebody that you're right, you should break it down in this symbolic form and say, these are my two premises, and see how they validly lead to the conclusion that I want you to draw. And then talk about how the premises are supported. I mean, that's the way we presented it as TAs in philosophy classes. But frankly, that's a load of crap as far as practical. Don't you think, Wes? I mean, do you ever feel like you need to do that?
Yes, utility is overhyped. You're talking about the use of formal symbols and...
Yes. I would feel philosophically illiterate if I didn't know what modus ponens was, right? The rule that says if A, then B, and the second premise is A, and the conclusion is B. I feel so educated knowing that Latin phrase. But at the same time, I wouldn't explicitly refer to that. I guess it's just a matter that you need to study this stuff because it gets your mind orderly, and that'll make you a better philosopher and not just go preaching mystical bullshit.
It is very clean. And one thing that symbolic logic does that just regular language doesn't do is it has a very grounded set of rules. If you're just using regular language, then there's homonyms and there's all these other things. You can use a word in a slightly different fashion than you actually intended, and people don't actually know what you're talking about. So I could see an argument for if you break it all the way down to the symbols, then there's no room to hide anymore. You can't hide in cushy words or arguments based on emotion or anything else like that. There's no room for anything but a rational construction of your argument.
Well, it forces you to disambiguate, certainly.
Although I think you can do that without the symbols. I think the symbols come in handy, are genuinely useful only when you get to very thorny problems like the one that motivates definite descriptions, the problem of false propositions and St. Anselm's proof for the existence of God, which sort of, you can't really show that that's illogical unless you get deep into this idea of quantification. Kant sort of gave the first disproof of that, but you really can't give the full explanation of how it fails until you introduce a concept like quantification. But for most purposes, I don't think that you need to know about quantification and use symbols to avoid error. People were doing it long before.
You know, that's a good specific that we might as well just fill out the example for a second, because that shows up in here. And if you looked at some of the blog posts, and I think we got into this a little on the Frege episode, that there's a fundamental distinction between sentences about individuals and general sentences where, you know, I'm saying Socrates is mortal or all men are mortal. So the two quantifiers are the all and the sum. And when you say some men are mortal, you're saying there exists some X such that X is a man and X is mortal, right? So yeah, you're actually affirming the existence of something. And the ontological argument, one of the arguments for the existence of God, is something like, I've got this idea of God.
Well, that's the Descartes version. So for St. Anselm, it's a definition, right? It's God is that which nothing greater can be conceived.
Yes.
It does involve idea in there.
You're right. That's better. If something has all of the qualities of perfection, then it will include existence, because certainly something that exists is better than something that doesn't exist.
Yeah, where perfection means better in the sense of more complete as well.
Uh-huh.
So to subtract existence would mean incompleteness. I mean, it's kind of similar to concerns about completeness in logic, but it fails because it doesn't. First of all, I mean, you'll see Russell will say outright in here, asserting existence of an individual isn't even meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
For Russell, making existence claims, strictly speaking, you're always doing it about an X. There exists an X such that, and then you give a description. And so here, what's being hidden is the fact that you have to make some sort of quantification claim before you give God a description, right? You have to say there exists an X such that X is blah, 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 blah. And because that quantification, that logical subtlety is missing, it's hard to figure out what's going on with Anselm's proof until you start to talk about quantification.
Since we brought it up, so Russell is saying just, well, according to my symbolization, existence is not a predicate. So you can't say for all X, X exists, or for all X, if it has the attributes of God, then it exists. That's not a meaningful sentence. You have to say there exists some X such that it has this properties. So either the ontological proof begs the question by just saying right off the fact, you know, in defining it, I'm saying it exists, which doesn't work.
Right.
Or you would have to put it using the other quantifier and saying for all X, if X has all these properties, then that entails that there exists some X that it has these properties. And that's just clearly invalid. So either it's begging the question or it's invalid. But why do we buy, I mean, you said you can't meaningfully assert the existence of an individual. So you can't say Socrates exists. Put the little quantification symbol for there exists some X or something, but don't put X, just put S. There exists Socrates.
Right.
Now, I understand why that's wrong according to the grammar of what Russell has set up, but why should we go with that? What's his justification, or what justification should we think of for that?
The basic sense that I got from it is just a confusion of levels of description. If you're talking about men collectively, then it's a different level than talking about an individual man. This level of individuals and existence and whatnot, and also the level of descriptions of individuals and all this other stuff.
He talks about this on 132 in chapter 15. You may correctly say men exist, meaning that X is a man is sometimes true. But if we make a pseudo-syllogism, men exist, Socrates is a man,
therefore Socrates exists, we are talking nonsense, since Socrates is not, like men, merely an undetermined argument to a given propositional function. The fallacy is closely analogous to that of the argument, men are numerous, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is numerous. In this case, it is obvious that the conclusion is nonsensical.
All right, well, we'll go more into, we're going to have some stuff specifically about arguments for the existence of God. So we don't have to spend too much time on this, but we're getting a flavor of the kind of way he's trying to solve philosophical problems by coming up with a clearer way of expressing what the sentences mean. And that forces, like we're saying, it forces you to disambiguate. Even though, of course, there are sort of artistic reasons why you might want to be ambiguous, or maybe there are some things that sound ambiguous. If you actually were to fill out what you actually mean, well, you're making a fruitful play on words. One of the things I remember that Tom, our guest on the Hegel episode, was saying, we were talking about desire and how people's inherently, before they have rich interactions with other people, they have a very empty sense of themselves. I remember he made sort of a play on words, which I'm sure was something from the secondary literature of, we're looking for content for the self, right? We're looking for the self not to be an empty definition. And when our desire is fulfilled, then we're contented. And it was sort of glossed over and we didn't jump on it at the time. But that's exactly the kind of thing that an analytic philosopher would say, come on, like,
yeah,
really? If you're making a substantial thesis with that, you need to stop and you need to spell it out. And you need to say why it's not just an etymological coincidence, why the word content and content look the same.
Right.
You know, the fact that they look the same does not freaking prove anything. And in fact, if you use a lot of language fast and loose like that, you're probably spouting bullshit.
Which is not to say that those sorts of things can't provide clues, you know, even if they are merely our groundless free association that can lead to certain ideas, which you can then substantiate in some other way.
Yes.
Free association still has its purpose. It's just important not to confuse it with, you know, proof or something like that.
So let's get back to the beginning of this book, I guess, which is him establishing the concept of number. And so the first couple of chapters are just about him setting up what is a number. And I think this is just straight from Frege. And we can go back and sort of piece some of the steps together in terms of his adjustments to Peano's axioms and things if we want. But I think the overall thrust of it was that a number gets defined, or you have to define the concept of number. Remember, he's trying to define all mathematical concepts in non-mathematical terms to say math is just a special case of these other more general logical terms. And so he defines numbers using this kind of recursive definition. So you could look at any particular set. I mean, we can look at it now already having the concept number and saying there are three things in this. But then how could you come up with the concept of number from that? I think it's you take one object, just pick a member of the set, and then pick another member of the set. And are those two the same? Right? And if in all cases, when you pick two members and they're the same, then that's how you've established one, right?
I got a different sense of it. He starts off with the set thing. And he starts off with numbers that aren't one. And he actually goes on for a little bit about how one is kind of sketchy to get to. And you have to go through this theory of types to get there. He basically says, if you have a group of things and then you can match each member of that group of things to another group of things. And then when you're done, there aren't any left on for either of them.
Yes.
Then you know that they're the same number, or they have this same quality that is numberness.
Right. They have a one-to-one correspondence. So he just talks about different sets whose members have a one-to-one correspondence. And that defines a group that all have something in common. And whatever that thing in common is, that's the number. So in fact, what the number ends up being is the set of sets that are like that.
Right.
Which is similar to each other, right? Is that the word?
Yes. Yeah. Right. So the way he puts it, the number three means the set of all trios. So in other words, the sets of all sets of things that have three numbers in it. But I can't actually say it like that because I don't want to put the number three in the definition.
Right.
So that's the trick. We have similarity. But then I thought that initially he got one out of that whole pick any two members or any two designations of a member, I should say. And if in all cases they refer to the same one, then that's one. And and you can do, just like you were saying, you can do a one-to-one correspondence. This set of one object, this one quarter in front of me, the set that includes just that thing is going to be similar. It's going to have map in a one-to-one correspondence to every other singleton set like that. And then it's just a matter of coming up with N plus one. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you do that and you correlate one to one and there's still one left over, there's still something left over, then you've got N plus one. So we've got N by with this correlation. And then is there something left over? All you need is this similarity and then you need one. And that gives you the whole system.
Yeah, I think he says something, N plus 1 is the collection of all classes such that if you take away a term X, then there is a class of N terms. I'm an engineer, so I'm more into the application of numbers versus the definition and just having a reason for using certain equations and stuff. So this is really, it was tough for me to get through. I was kind of, it's just one. Just deal with it. Let's move on.
It's basic. Yeah, well, that's the problem. This is why he says that mathematical philosophy is necessary, because a mathematician just takes certain things as basic. And he says, of course, some things have to be basic because we can't just keep driving back forever. As a practical matter, we have to stop our explanation somewhere. But as mathematical philosophers or as philosophical mathematicians, we should push that back as far as possible.
So what are our most basic, what basic principles are we left with? The concept of succession.
It's basically Peano's axioms.
Well, it's like, it's a reduced set of them, right? I think he's going to end up with two, right?
Yeah.
But there's originally five axioms, and this is on page 4.
Read them off, just so people have a sense of what we're talking about.
Zero is a number. The successor of any number is a number. No two numbers have the same successor. Zero is not the successor of any number. And any property which belongs to zero, and also to the successor of every number which has the property, belongs to all numbers, which is the principle of mathematical induction.
And of course, he's just dealing with whole numbers, or he calls them natural numbers, but he's including zero in there, which immediately, what do you mean there's no number before zero? Isn't it negative one before zero? Come on. But you can see, I mean, we've already defined Russell. He's trying to define numerals, these cardinal numbers, in terms of sets of actual things, of trios in the world. So you can't have negative one things considered as counting actual objects. So being able to talk about negatives at all is something that is derived, is much later. If you can set up the concept of numbers, and then you can set up adding one and getting rid of one, then you can set up negative numbers.
Yeah. Right.
But you need this first.
Right.
You can sort of derive that from the successor principle. And I looked a little bit into the Principia, and just to get a grip on how slowly these things develop, Principia Mathematica has three volumes. And then there was like an additional one that he wrote later. But it takes until page 86 of the second volume to prove that 1 plus 1 equals 2. And Russell is just really, really good at the sort of the tongue-in-cheek humor. And immediately after it, he says, the above proposition is occasionally useful. All of this stuff is just so slow to develop. It's admirable that he got as far as he did. He even sort of acknowledges when he's talking about classes and stuff that the theory of classes isn't entirely self-contained. It's got a little bit of a hand wave about it. It's still not a 100% rigorous basis for natural numbers and such. I think he does a pretty good job.
Well, we know that ultimately it's going to fail, Ryan.
Right.
You can't give a completely logical foundation to arithmetic.
Spoilers! Spoilers!
Need some non-arithmetic notion. Sorry, non-logical notion to ground arithmetic.
By chapter 3, he finishes his analysis of Peano's axioms and says that it ends up that we can derive two of them, the one asserting that zero is a number and the one asserting mathematical induction. That is, if something is true of X, then it's true of X plus 1. But how did you say that?
Yeah, it's the successors.
It's true of X. It's true of X plus 1.
Inheritable traits.
Yes.
Inheritable traits of numbers.
You can define those two in terms of the other ones. I think the philosophically important point for me here was to get to the idea that he defines these numbers in terms of sets. So you might just reject that whole thing and say that's ridiculous. Say, no, numbers are pure mathematical entities, just like the Pythagoreans say. It's often hard for me. I mean, I guess we can derive the notion of numbers from these notions of sets. So is that enough to say, here, I've given a derivation. Does that mean that the sets are more basic than the numbers? The fact that he's done that? Or is it just pointing out a correspondence? You could say the numbers are the more basic and sets are derived from those somehow.
I think that numbers are things that we have some sort of sense of them, but a set, like a group of things, is something that people have an intuitive grasp of.
The other thing is that you've achieved a greater level of generality and shown mathematics to be a special case of it, right?
Right.
So it'd be like in any science, you're looking for the most general principles. And if you can show, you're essentially reducing one to the other in that case.
Right. And his other criticism of Peano was not only just that, look, I can analyze his axioms and a couple of them are superfluous, but that they weren't actually rooted in the real world, like you're saying. In fact, the number 100, the number 101, 102, etc., those, that set, starting with 100, obeys all of Peano's axioms, right? Just define 100 to be equal to the symbol 0.
Yeah.
And it all works. Like, but no, we need whatever you call the number 2 to line up with the number of eyes that people usually have.
Right.
We need those symbols to hook up with things in the actual world. So you can't, the way he thought Peano was doing it, define them purely in terms of symbols and say the symbols are a world unto themselves. That just defeats the purpose that we have for mathematics, which is to support engineering, say, counting and building things.
Well, I do appreciate that because it does keep me in video games and such. But yeah, he basically says that the two axioms that he comes up with, they're assumptions, and that math operates independently of reality, and it's only by tethering the set of one, the set of all ones and the number one to one entity in the real world that it has any sort of function with regards to reality.
Of course, with logic, in the last chapter, we get the idea that logical truths are true even if the world doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So they're completely untethered.
And you might ask, why do we need the notion of sets and talking about one-to-one correspondences between sets? Why can't we just count what's in there? And he has a quote here. This is in chapter 2 here. So he's talking about, we've got these bundles of different numbers of objects, and we don't have the concept of number yet. He says, how shall we decide whether two collections belong to the same bundle, right? Whether these are both trios or both duos? The answer that suggests itself is, find out how many members each has and put them in the same bundle if they have the same number of members. But this presupposes we've defined numbers and we know how to discover how many terms a collection has.
Right.
We are so used to the operation of counting that such a presupposition might easily pass unnoticed. In fact, however, counting, though familiar, is logically a very complex operation. Moreover, it is only available as a means of discovering how many terms a collection has when the collection is finite. Our definition of number must not assume in advance that all numbers are finite, and we cannot in any case, without a vicious circle, use counting to define numbers, because numbers are used in counting. So it's not just a matter of, like, I can go this, that, the next, and we just assign the numbers 1, 2, 3 sort of arbitrarily, and of course we could use base 8 or whatever. I mean, that seems like the intuitive. That's how we came up with numbers, is counting. I don't know. What do you think of that? Because it seems like old counting systems, you could do 1, 2, 3, many, right? Isn't that whole how the cavemen would count?
Yeah.
The concept of high numbers was... So it certainly doesn't presuppose the whole number system, the fact that you can count at all. So I don't know. That seems, at least anthropologically, you could give an argument that some form of counting is basic. And he makes a reference to that.
Well, psychologically it is, yeah. But we're talking about logically here. So you can't use the psychological fact that counting is prior in this case because it already assumes number. We want to reduce the concept of number to something that doesn't involve that concept. Otherwise, we're begging the question. And that's where we get this similarity between classes.
So I guess the choices are either try to pursue some route like this, or just say it's just basic. It's just a priori basic. We have these concept of numbers, which is exactly the thing that he's wants to discount, that if he thinks he can give, like you were saying, this more general, like in the sciences, explanation of number in terms of, you know, of course, there are lots of other properties of groups besides their one-to-one correspondence with other groups. So if we can say this special property of actual things in the world and we can get number from that, then we're, I don't know. I don't know if that's a good example of a generalization. That sounds more like a type of abstraction than... saying counting is a special case of some larger operation which doesn't necessarily involve numbers. I think the more important part of this argument here is just that he wants to leave in there the notion of infinity. And he spends a couple chapters talking about different types of infinity, I think using stuff from Cantor, not really his own work, but which were some of the most interesting chapters, even though those are not among the ones that were assigned for this particular, or not as philosophically relevant, I think.
Yeah, and you can't just get rid of infinity. You can't found arithmetic and everything you need to do if you get rid of infinity.
Yeah, he works really hard to sort of give a good foundation for the concept of infinity. So if you're just doing numbers and you're just defining numbers as collections of things and comparing those collections of things to other collections of things, then you can only have a number system that goes as high as the number of things that you have in the universe. So if you took every single possible thing in the universe and grouped it into a set, then you can only have...
Or actual thing, I think you'd have to say.
Yeah, or actual things, not abstract things. But
right.
So if you take all of the actual things in the universe and put them in one group and then make a number out of that group, you can't get anything higher than that. So you have to have an infinite number of numbers. It's actually kind of ingenious. He does basically permutation theory. If you only have two things in your universe, you count the possible groups of things that you can have. So you can have one thing or the other thing or both things together. So now you have three classes or three potential groups of things, and then you can count those groups of things. You say, well, I have this group of things, I have this other group of things, and I have this other group of things, and now you have four, and you can just build up from there and get to infinity that way.
He proposes that, but he rejects it.
Right.
He set up this definition of number in terms of actual things. He's acknowledged the problem that you just pointed out, that if we have a finite number of things in the universe. And so he says, can we prove this, what he calls the axiom of infinity, which is the statement that there positively are infinitely many things in the universe. And he says, there's just no way in terms of the individuals, the particulars, that we could prove that. Even if we're looking at, I guess, the way we talked about this on the Kant episode, not getting bigger and bigger, but looking at smaller and smaller subsections of things. Isn't right. that where Kant thought you get the notion of infinity? Just look at this inch here. I can divide it up infinitely many times. Right there, we have the notion of infinity. But the way he's going to define that in his discussion of irrational numbers is actually by saying, no matter how many times you divide it, count up now the number of divisions. That's always a finite number.
Right.
You can keep doing it, but you just keep getting a finite number. You don't actually know.
Well, yeah, and whether or not it gives us the concept of infinity isn't relevant. That may be right, that we get the concept of infinity that way, I don't know. But even then, the real question is whether or not there are a finite or infinite number of elements in the world.
Right.
Which we can't know except empirically.
Yeah, maybe there is a smallest division.
Yeah.
So that there are some sort of atoms, quanta or something, and no further division is possible. So therefore, there's a finite number of things in the universe. And then he makes that move that you just pointed out, Josh, where he says, well, can we get around this and prove the axiom of infinity anyway by using this set theoretic trick? And the ridiculous way would, even if you had a universe with only one thing in it, you could say, well, I've got the thing.
And then nothing.
And I've got, well, yeah, that's right. I've got the thing and I've got the empty set. And then I've got the the set that includes both.
The thing and nothing.
Yes. Actually, you have a universe with nothing in it. You have only the empty set. Isn't there then a set that contains just the empty set? So it has one thing in it. It has the empty set. And then you have another set that contains the set I was just talking about it. And then it also has the empty set in it. So it has three things. It has the empty set. It has the set that has the empty set. And then it has the empty set that's within that set. That has the... But he ends up denouncing this as pure chicanery just based on Russell's paradox.
Right.
Which is that if you start taking sets seriously in this way, then paradoxes result. So we've now admitted that, for instance, there could be a set with everything in it. Okay, but then if the set that has everything in it, does that set belong to that set that has everything in it? There seems to be no good answers. Like, no, I mean, the set of all men doesn't have man in general as one of its members. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the set itself. Like, you never really have a set as a member of itself. So you ask about what about the set of sets that don't have themselves as a member. Does that set of sets that don't have themselves as a member have itself as a member or not? If it does, then it shouldn't be in there. If it doesn't, then it should be in there.
Right. And so you reach a logical contradiction and it doesn't work. I read a little bit about Russell's personal views on how mathematics is justified and whatnot. And he was the founder of a school of thought that was called, I'm going to try and say this, it's kind of percussive, it's predicativism. It's kind of a fun word, but he's basically going back to that idea that we talked about where you can't confuse levels of sets. Because if you have a set that's trying to reference itself, you can only have a set that references things that are below it in this sort of tiered set theory of logic. You can have a thing, and then you can have a set of a thing, but you can't have a set that describes both the set of the thing and the thing. You can't mix levels.
Yeah.
So to take another example of that, if we were talking about this in terms of predicates, which are one way of determining set membership, if you said, take the set of all the things that are red, and I can predicate red of all those things, well, on a second level, I might want to talk about red itself and attribute things to red and say things about red. But red is never one of those things that I could say about
it. Right, it's a class of those things.
That will belong always to the lower level. Red isn't the type of thing to be red. And so I have to leave that on the lower level, and I make other sorts of, on the second level, assertions about red as a predicate.
Exactly. The concept horse is not a horse.
There you go.
We discussed that in the Freya episode. That's the quick description of his theory of types, Russell's theory of types, which is what he uses to get out of this contradiction. So he hasn't solved the problem of is the axiom of infinity true or not? And he ends that chapter 13 by saying, whether that axiom is true or false, there seems no known method of discovering. So we kind of need it just for the math to make sense, right? Because if we don't have enough, like you were saying, just to spell this out, if we only have a finite number of objects in the real world, so if there are really only 6 objects, then that would violate the fundamental principles of arithmetic, because then when we get to 7, well, what does the number 7 refer to? Well, it's the set of all sets of objects that have 7 things in them, but there are not 7 things anywhere in the world, so it equals the empty set.
Right.
Well, the number 8 also equals the empty set. The number 9 also equals the empty set. So we have all these numbers that end up being in one-to-one correspondence with each other being the empty set, and that's explicitly not how it's supposed to work. That violates induction.
Right.
Yeah, they cease to be successors of each other in
yes.
the proper sense.
Right. Induction just means, again, that the succession rule.
If some theorem applies to n, it applies to n plus 1.
Right. And the fact that something is not equal to its predecessor is one of those properties that is supposed to be inductive.
Yeah, he defines a whole slew of things that are supposed to be things that have a relationship to numbers that are bigger than a certain number. And he's got this hereditary property definition where there are certain qualities of numbers that are inherited by numbers that are larger than them or come later than them on the number line.
Yep.
And so an inductive number is said to be less than another number when it possesses every hereditary property possessed by the successor of that number. Kind of a tautological thing where he's, oh, this is heredity, and it's the thing that everything that comes after this number, all of the successors of this number have this property, or the induction is said to be having this hereditary property.
Yes, so that's chapter 4 about succession. So once he's defined what sort of individual numbers are, he has to define the set that is the sequence.
Chapter 3, right?
I thought succession didn't get there till chapter 4.
I didn't read chapter 4. Therefore, it doesn't exist.
If you take the set of all chapters, you know, there has to be, even if there were only 3 chapters, then the set of all chapters would have 4 elements in it. So.
No, you're right. That's chapter 3. Chapter 4 is the definition of order. He's building up more complicated kinds of numbers, because what a number ends up being, right, is a bunch of sets. We've defined it that way. And so once you define it in terms of sets, then you can distinguish between cardinal numbers, which is just, you know,
it's a set of sets.
A set of sets, right. So the number 3 is the set of all trios. But that leaves open, like, well, what order are the things in the trios? Do they go 1, 2, 3, or do they go 1, 3, 2, or whatever? So you could define the cardinal number 3 is that set where it doesn't matter what order they are, but then you could define ordinal numbers where the order does matter. And that actually seems to only matter when you get to different types of infinity. So this type of infinity that goes just 1, 2, 3, 4 up to infinity is one kind of infinity, but the one that goes 1, 2, 4, all the even numbers up to infinity, and then starts the odd numbers from the beginning, starting with 3 or something up to infinity, that's a different ordinal number. And it's a bigger, because it goes up to infinity twice. So you can't map it into a one-to-one correspondence with the natural numbers type of infinity, the basic kind. So it's a greater degree of infinity. Anyway, it's where it gets crazy ass.
Yeah, that's Cantor stuff. And I remember when I first read about Cantor, I was reading about his work on infinities and different levels of infinity and all this stuff. And then it ended with, and he went stark raving mad. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, I could see that, you know? You're thinking about things that are infinitely large. And then you're saying, well, this thing that is infinitely large is infinitely larger than this other thing that is infinitely large. And he has this whole thing with countability, and Aleph 0 is countable, and then there's the Aleph 1. You can't count that one, and so on and so forth. It just gets pretty crazy. No wonder he went bonkers.
So we'll put a little description of some of this or a link on the webpage for folks who want to know more about these degrees of infinity. The interesting thing to point out, just the fact that he's bringing this up, he seemed to want to root mathematics in the empirical, in sets of actual things. But here he's insisting that we have to assume that the axiom of infinity is correct because he wants to talk about all this higher level math. Why? Why not just be a dunce empiricist and say, if once you get too abstracted, you're just in fantasy land and real scientific mathematics should remain applicable?
That's a good question.
Are there applications of these notions of infinity and other things that I'm not thinking of right now?
Well, first of all, the natural numbers, right, are just, by definition, the set on which you can do induction, and induction requires infinity.
Right, so basic addition and subtraction actually require infinity.
I don't think you're going to get 1 plus 1 equals 2 without infinity, right? Or maybe I'm wrong about that, but...
No, that's true, because if you're doing this whole counting thing and you don't have the concept of infinity with it, then the number 1 is indistinguishable from the number 2 because they're both equivalent to the empty set. So, you know, 1 plus 1 equals 2 doesn't hold anymore. 1 plus 1 could equal 0 or 3 or any other number that you want because... Yeah.
So we need at least the basic kind of infinity,
yeah.
The Aleph zero, as you're referring to it, Josh.
Yeah, fuck that crazy Cantor infinity. That's just regular infinity for me, man.
Right, and he's given us the tools for dealing with these higher levels of infinity because it all has to do with one-to-one correspondence, so that if you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., and you have 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, etc., you can still map those in one-to-one correspondence. So that's what makes them the same kind of infinity. It's all just based on the same rules by which he set this up.
Yeah.
I'm again sort of thinking about the ontological status here. And what I'm tempted to say is, given that I know he's an empiricist, is that you abstract from actual objects to get the basic numbers, but then you, out of that, build an axiomatic system that ends up applying to things that no longer need have any reference to the actual world, right? So you could build up these symptoms of infinity.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this talk about sets themselves, I mean, he calls them fictions, right? Or classes is his word.
Yeah.
Well, we already said why he doesn't want classes to be ontologically real, because you end up having those stupid problems. Well, do you, or is it just the theory of types that solves the problem of the set of all sets that are not members of themselves? Russell's paradox I referred to. Is that just the reason for adopting the theory of types, or is that the reason for getting rid of the ontological reality of sets altogether?
Well, let's look at page 110 at the bottom, beginning of the last paragraph. He's talking about the theory of types and the problem that leads to it. The fallacy consists in the formation of what we may call impure classes, classes which are not pure as to type. As we shall see in a later chapter, classes are logical fictions, and a statement which appears to be about a class will only be significant if it is capable of translation into a form in which no mention is made of the class. I mean, it looks like here he thinks there's an independent reason to suppose that classes are logical fictions. That fact will help with his paradox, but it sounds like he thinks there's going to be an independent reason in the later chapter.
15 is where he starts to talk about propositional functions, which is all building up, I think, to we can get rid of classes and talk about functions instead.
So when you get to 182 in the margin, you see that symbols for classes are mere conveniences, not representing objects called classes. Classes are, in fact, like descriptions, logical fictions, or incomplete symbols.
Are you talking about the axiom of reducibility to get rid of classes and replace them with functions?
Yes.
Okay, this is 194. I'm reading off of my notes, so I can't tell if this is a direct quote from the text or if it's just me paraphrasing, but there is a type of a function that can take a single variable, such that given any such a function, it is formally equivalent to an a function of that type.
Right.
Yes. So again, people that listen to the Frege episode where we talked about propositional functions, this should seem a little familiar. It's more spelled out in this text than it was in there. But the idea is that now he's defined not just mathematically, right? Again, mathematics is going to be a specific application of this more general thing you can do, is he's talking about functions. And in fact, most sentences are just applying a predicate, which can be thought of as a function, to a number of individuals. So if I say all bugs are small or something, I'm saying for all x, if x is a bug, then x is small. And that's a function. I can take a domain of stuff. In this case, the domain we're looking at, well, it's really of everything. But the antecedent there was we're just looking at the class of bugs. So it's mapping all these x's that it's looking at onto yes or no, right? Is it small or is it not small?
Right, true statements or false statements.
Yes, exactly. What a predicate is a function mapping a set of objects onto true or false. So that's why it's called the propositional function. And to spell out a general statement like this about all bugs or some bugs or some things or all things is going to be ranging over a whole domain, as opposed to, you know, Socrates is small, which unless you want to interpret it as a description. You know, you could pick out the individual Socrates, or you could say, for all X, if X is the philosopher that Plato was writing about in all those dialogues, I'm giving a description, which, you know, theoretically, maybe it doesn't refer to anybody. Maybe Plato just made up this person.
Right. That was important.
Yes. So it maps individuals onto small or not small. And in this case, it's just trying to pick out one individual to see whether Plato was small or not. I don't know how clear that was to listeners that are going to... this is new too.
He talks about formal equivalence, and he says that functions are formally equivalent if they always produce the same results. So like, if you have a function that is formally equivalent to another function, then for every true that one function returns, the other function will also return a true. And for every false that one function returns, the other one will return a false. So it does away with classes, because if you have a function formally equivalent to another function of the same type, then you can define a class that way.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about classes, you have a problem if you're just trying to define it from a function, because if you say X is small, then that's true for bugs and thumbtacks and atoms and a whole bunch of things that don't really belong in sets together. But if you want to define a set of things, then you can just go ahead and take a function. If you have a function that's formally equivalent to another function, which is like X is a bug and X is small. So for whatever X you choose, if both of those functions always return the same value, then they're formally equivalent, and you can define a class by comparing the things that return the same value in those two functions.
Right. And actually, I like the way you put that, because so we just did this with number. We ontologically got rid of the concept of number by defining it in terms of something more basic, which are sets. And now we're defining sets in terms of a set of, defining sets in terms of equivalent functions. So just to give a real life example, humans and featherless bipeds, let's say that those two concepts pick out all the same thing. Or a creature with a heart and creature with a stomach. Or there are a few other examples that are given like that. So in other words, these predicates clearly mean different things. The word human doesn't mean featherless bipeds, but these pick out all the same things. In fact, there are infinitely many more descriptions you can give of this one group of things, right, which are picked up by humans and picked up by featherless bipeds. And what he wants to say is that take the totality of those predicates, right, the totality of those functions, and those things together define this set.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it sounds like, well, maybe aren't you defining the predicates in terms of the set? Well, no, clearly the predicates mean different things. So you're not saying, look at those objects. Now I've defined what human is, because there are lots of descriptions you can give to that group of objects. You are, in fact, defining the group via the descriptions, not the other way around. Consider the predicate all humans that are not Seth Paskin. So that almost picks out all the same things, but it has one member different. That shows you that even though there was a very similar meaning there, if my whole notion of human, I'd never met Seth. So those two predicates to my mind would be identical. The fact is that in some circumstance, they could break apart. When Seth comes along, oh, now they've broken apart, which is getting into another area of just what concepts are in general and how Aristotle defines all concepts in terms of necessary and sufficient conditions for being a human or being whatever. And Wittgenstein comes later and says, no, you got to focus on prototypical cases versus borderline cases. I know we've gotten into this on some other episodes. So this is just gesturing at the fact that these predicates are more basic than the sets themselves.
Right.
So what do we have in our world? Ontologically, we have individuals and we have predicates. We have descriptions of them. Or is that right? Or are the descriptions
The descriptions
you quoted
are
before,
fictions
the description
as
goes
well.
Away too. So it's just individuals.
Individuals and properties.
Okay. For the properties that individuals have. Sure. Yeah.
And then we have to make up this whole prepositional functions, rather, to define those in different kinds of classes or sets or what have you. And then from there, we can get to numbers. And then from there, so long as we assume the axiom of infinity, then we can get to higher mathematics as sort of a function of the real world. So there are still some assumptions that have to be made, but...
Right.
And he does say he's agnostic on whether or not they really are fictions. He's not definitively saying that classes or sets are fictions. He's agnostic. For the purpose of Occam's razor, if you can get rid of them and define them in terms of propositional functions, then you've gotten rid of them.
Yeah, I thought of another example that we've used in another podcast that I'm sure Josh did not listen to, which was the Nelson Goodman one on GRU and Bleen. So we have this concept of green and we have this concept of GRU, which means all things that are green right now, but after, you know, tomorrow, some point in time, that concept GRU will refer to the blue things instead. If you want to say, no, sets are basic and predicates are based on them, well, no, the sets always underdetermine what the predicate is, because this set that I'm looking at right now of all these green things, is that actually defining the concept green, or is that defining the concept GRU? Because this concept GRU is a really weird one that is going to jump to a different group of things later. And we have a whole discussion on that podcast of why Goodman thought that you can't just say, oh, well, because green is basic and GRU is just a dumb thing you made up. Like, no, because you could define green in terms of GRU. You could make GRU the basic one. Anyway, I won't go into that in detail, but that's the same kind of thinking that's going on here, to say that these groupings that we attach to things are in some way arbitrary. They're not a part of the fundamental furniture of the universe.
Yeah, he uses that furniture of the universe phrase a couple of times, and I have to say that I was just thinking of like an ottoman floating in space somewhere every time you mentioned it.
It is a cute phrase. Have we gone through everything? We've set up numbers. We define them in terms of classes. We now have potentially done away with the classes by talking about propositions. I guess we should talk more about propositional functions and descriptions and that kind of stuff.
All right.
I assume, Josh, you did not have prior introduction to this description stuff. What did you get out of this?
It was an interesting way of thinking of just what mathematics actually represents and how it can be defined. I read some of Gödel's philosophy as a sort of like a contrast to this. He was sort of a new age, a Neoplatonist in regards to his ideas about mathematics. And in his mind, math exists in an objective way. It has an objective reality to it. In his mind, you can learn things about mathematics the same way that you learn things about the rules of the universe through science, where you make a theory, and then if it holds true for all cases, then it's probably something that's true about math and stuff like that. So he was more along the lines of math is this sort of floaty thing that exists outside of human conception in some capacity.
Well, that's interesting. You're characterizing it as a floaty thing outside human conception, but that we get at it the same way we get at scientific matters, which implies it's not a floaty thing outside human conception. Maybe I'm just misunderstanding.
Well, it's not outside of conception. It's outside of, doesn't come from empirical observation.
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
It's not something that we just made up. It's not a fantasy. Whereas Russell, and it's very strange, the sort of levels of saying, yes, it's real. Yes, numbers are real. No, numbers aren't real and stuff like that, because Gödel is a Platonist. So he has this idea that numbers are a real thing. And then there's Russell, who says we derive numbers from this empirical basis of groups of stuff. And we just make a couple of assumptions and then we get this whole mathematics thing. But he also along the way says the axiom of infinity, we just made up. We don't really know for sure. The rigor that he's trying to use here, I feel like if he was just going for rigor, he kind of falls short insofar as saying that mathematics is a direct derivative of the real world.
See, I don't think he's an empiricist, though. He's in the sense that he's thinking that mathematical truths depend on empirical observations, right? Because in that case,
right,
we might someday find out that 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4, or we might be able to conceive of a possible world in which 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4. But that's not the case for Russell. You know, and for Russell, right, the world could not exist and these logical truths would hold. They're that independent, and then the mathematical truths sort of supervene on those logical truths. So there is, I think, a great deal of independence.
It's interesting. He's trying to provide a grounding for math. And so we're not allowed to just postulate things because it's convenient to do so. So, for instance, in Chapter 7, and I refer to this in an offhand way, you might think, again, that we have the notion of infinity for sure, because between any two points on a number line, there are infinitely many other points. And he considers irrational numbers, and he says the square root of 2, for instance. He thinks he can show that there's a gap. Now, not only is there not just a continuum of possible numbers between 1 and 2, say, right? Am I saying this right? Yes.
1.4, 1 something.
Yes, that's right. You might think there's a continuum of numbers in there because there are infinitely many of them, and that gives us the notion of infinity, whatever. But he says that, look, the square root of 2 proves that there are gaps. And you could say the square root of 2 is just like an, let's just call it a limit, and things sort of approach it. It's asymptotal. things approach it, just like the notion of infinity at the top of the cardinal number stream, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., LF0, that's the regular infinity. And that's an asymptote. It's just a concept that we use that things go toward. Well, can't we see the square root of 2 is just that same kind of thing? And we can still say, yes, there's just a continuum of infinitely many numbers between 1 and 2. He says, no. He says, other mathematicians, perceiving that there was no rational limit to ratios whose square is less than 2, they allowed to postulate an irrational limit, which was to fill the gap. Dedekind, who is the guy that was coming up with this, in the above-mentioned work, set up the axiom that the gap must always be filled, that every section must have a boundary. It is for this reason that the series where his axioms are verified are called Dedekindian, but there are an infinite number of series for which it is not verified. This method of postulating what we want has many advantages. They are the same as the advantages of theft over honest toil. Let us leave them to others and proceed with our honest toil.
Well, you could say the same thing of the theory of types, though.
Yep.
The axiom of infinity and axiom of reducibility.
Just any sort of mathematical assumption is pretty much the same thing.
Right. Well, he makes a big point in here. It says, look, I'm giving you the theory of types only in a very rough way. And really, if you're going to ground it, it needs much, much more discussion. And I don't know enough about the theory of types to see whether he gave it enough more discussion. I think I understand.
Well, it's only motivation. I mean, it's only justification is that it avoids paradox.
Okay. All right.
It's a stipulation to avoid paradox, to avoid. So you say self-reference is hereby prohibited. Well, that's very convenient.
And this was, I wanted to bring up the Dedekindian gaps here, because that was an argument that sort of plays into his overall atomism. You know, we've just talked about how his ultimate ontology seems to only have these individuals and their properties. And any of these larger sets and things, those are all just logical fictions that we use cognitively to organize things and talk about them. But what the actual individuals are metaphysically, like, who the hell knows? You can go listen to our first episode on Wittgenstein to hear us go round and round and round trying to figure out, according to Wittgenstein and even Russell, what these basic elements end up being.
Although for him, the atoms are going to be facts, right? Atomic facts, rather than just little properties and individuals floating about. They're sort of attached to each other, and that's where you get the atom is that little dyad.
Yes. So we see in here this atomic way of looking at things is, of course, an argument against the opposite, which is that everything is all is one. Parmenides is right. Everything is... There's a continuum between all things. There's an interdependence between all things. I mean, if you're an atomist, ultimately there are these, you can analyze things down to these independent points, which do not depend on each other for existence, which is just entirely against, for instance, what it seemed like Hegel was saying, which, of course, Russell in his early career was a Hegelian following F.H. Bradley, this thing was English Hegelian. So his switch over to this atomism was a big shift for him, that he was rebelling against one of the prevalent trends of his time, because he just saw that all that is ultimately fuzzy-headed. So it just comes down to a very... I'm just trying to characterize in a roundabout way, if it was not already grossly obvious, what analytic philosophy...
And one way of saying, you know, putting the idealist position in its opposition to the atomism is to say that you couldn't say anything about one of these individuals without giving all of its relations to everything else in the world.
Yep. Right. And you might say, well, psychologically, sure. Like, the only reason we know darkness is because we have the concept of light or something. But he wants to say that you can analyze these things down to the actual metaphysical components of the world are going to be discrete. And I'll link to an article that one of our blog readers, Burl, had put a link to originally in order to really criticize it, actually, as Russell being extremely shallow in his analysis. I didn't think it was that bad, but of his ultimate metaphysics. So we can read a little more about that. We only get, again, hints of it here, but he's clearly trying in his philosophy of mathematics to leave room for the coherence of his own metaphysical views. Is that the most we can say of how much this relates to actual philosophy, that it is compatible with his views on actual philosophical topics?
It does leave room for it.
What numbers are is a philosophical question.
But it's interesting. I mean, because Frege, too, was a Platonist. We just got through talking about that. And yet his reduction of number to logic is the same as Russell's. I mean, they are both logicists. It's just that their view of the ontological status of logic is different. Yeah. That for Frege, he's actually pulling logic out of the realm of abstractions from the empirical into the ethereal Platonic realm, whereas Russell seems to be wanting to pull math the other way.
Right.
Into things by definition, ultimately rooted in empirical particulars. So.
You just blew my mind, man.
So I can pretend to be Seth and repeat his closing to the Frege episode and say, okay, I get this. So what? How does this impact my... And it's interesting that Russell, like, just stopped bothering to do this after the Principia Mathematica. I read a couple reasons for that, one of which was he read about Gödel's undermining his system, right? This attempt to define everything mathematical in purely logical terms. And you were saying Gödel's incompleteness proof showed that that was actually not possible. Probably we'll just put up a link, unless you want to explain it.
Yeah, I can do it pretty quick.
Go ahead.
Gödel's incompleteness theorem sort of revolves around the same sort of approach as Russell's paradox, which is if you have a mathematical system that is of sufficient complexity to describe itself, or the way that he approaches it is a mathematical system that's of sufficient complexity to derive basic arithmetic,
yep,
which is the basis for the rest of mathematics. If you have a system that's that complex, then it is necessarily complex enough to reference itself. And in referencing itself, you can propose this sort of logically inconsistent statement within the system. You can state this sort of, this sentence is false statement within the system. You can't evaluate that to be true or false within the system. And so it's necessarily what mathematicians call incomplete, which means that it can't evaluate everything within the system to be true or false.
Right. So that's what a thorough axiomatic system is supposed to do, is you're supposed to be able to look at every single sentence in there, right, yeah, and judge it to be true or false. And ground most of them, yeah, on other things, yeah, to the basic postulates.
So there'd be at least one proposition in the system which must be true but can't be proven.
He demonstrated this all mathematically, of course, but it's kind of cool to think about it in just non-mathematic terms. Just like if you have a system like, say, the English language that is broad enough to describe itself, then there are going to be terms within that system that are necessarily irreconcilable. You can't determine them to be true or false either way. So in English, there is this sentence is false. And he has a more complete incompleteness theorem where you can sort of try and patch up systems by saying this system is self-complete except for this one statement that says this statement is false. And that one always evaluates to true. And you could try and like patch holes in it, but then you can still find what's called a Gödel number, which is that statement for that system. You can find that no matter how many times you try and patch it up, it just falls apart at some level.
Hmm.
There are more folks besides Russell to, I think, fully understand what that knocks down. But yes, it knocks down any supposedly self-contained axiomatic system, which certainly Russell was trying to build here. Right? Or ones that other people had built, he was trying to approve of.
Yeah. There was another system that was derived around the same time that was quite a bit more popular than Russell's system that was called the Zermelo-Frankel system.
Mm.
Yes, that's actually what I was thinking of.
You know, it's a straightforward list of axioms that you can build set theory and arithmetic from, but it was a great deal more popular than Russell's system insofar as mathematicians building the basis for arithmetic and such.
Yeah, it's still what's used, I think, right?
Yeah, people generally, they'll use ZFC,
yep,
which is Zermelo-Frankel with what's called the axiom of choice, which was an interesting and sort of, you know, Russell was assuming these things like infinity and stuff like that. And it turns out that you have to assume things that are even more basic than that, just that if you have two things that are the same, then you can just pick one of them. So most mathematicians today use ZFC as the basis for all of their rudimentary foundations.
So either, according to some reports, Russell abandoned this project because of Gödel, or what I read is that Whitehead was his math teacher and made him do most of the work in actually deriving all of the theorems for the Principia Mathematica. And once he was done with that, he was just freaking burned out on that. He just did not want to do that crap anymore.
Hmm.
So he ended up writing more on politics. He wrote Why I Am Not a Christian, a very famous atheist book. And you might ask, you know, it would take a good analysis of his work that I don't feel like I could characterize right now to say what, if any, connection there is between these things other than just by doing philosophy of math, he got so he would think very clearly and use what he thought to be common sense or something.
Well, this definitely shows a level of rigor that you don't usually see in early philosophy, to be sure. So you've got Plato that's, there must be these things because I can conceive of them. There must be these pure things that exist outside reality that reality is merely a shadow of. And Russell's like, I'm going to need you to write down some symbols real quick just to clarify what exactly it is that you're saying.
I mean, I think there are sophisticated reasons for Plato's assertions and the same sorts of reasons that motivate, say, Frege and Gödel. So it seems to me that the formalization doesn't push you in one direction or another, you know, to being a Platonist or not. So
yes, I knew Wes was not going to let that aspersion on Plato. Oh, Plato is just non-systematic and just kind of bullshitting his way through things. Like, no.
Well, I wasn't going to say it exactly in those terms.
But that's the way sociologically things get passed down, that Plato himself is the same with Hegel. When we read closely Plato and Hegel, we can find very sophisticated arguments going on here, even if they're not spelled out in as nice a manner as a current analytic philosopher would like. But the people influenced by both of those philosophers, the layman's version that would then be floating around in intellectual circles of these guys, is going to be much more sloppy. And so yeah, what people are reacting to, certainly the version of Hegel that Russell was reacting to, I don't think has a hell of a lot to do with the actual Hegel. Without actually reading a bunch of F.H. Bradley, I can't say that for sure, go listen to the Hegel episode. And it seems like there's something sophisticated going on that this is not a refutation of.
I like that.
Or to the Theaetetus episode, for that matter.
Yeah, it's all about predication.
Right. Plus the fact that Plato was so systematically just going through different models of knowledge and sort of knocking them down one by one by one, and you don't come up with a clear positive, let alone a really simplistically positive, oh, there's a world of forms and that's what basic. There are textual things to argue about with that. But I guess that's what's frustrating. This is a good point to relate back to what I was commenting on, Tom's use of the metaphor going with this Heideggerian tack of talking about the two different definitions of content and contentful. And we had a similar thing on the blog where he was using the term normative in a way that was, you know, not clearly what I understood to be normative in an analytic philosophy ethics discussion. And that's because he studied philosophy through a communications background, and they really like their postmodernists and have sort of a different language of approaching this kind of thing. Whereas somebody that's going to be a future guest on this podcast had listened to a couple of our continental philosophy episodes and said, well, it sounds like you guys have no background in analytic philosophy at all. But even though a lot of our interest is in these guys like Hegel and Heidegger, we're approaching it from an analytic philosophy perspective.
That's a very bizarre thing for him to say, yeah.
And that doesn't mean that we're reducing things to symbolic logic or referring explicitly to Russell or having Russellian kind of views. It's just all about writing clearly, about disambiguating, about trying not to sound smart, really. It's about trying to make yourself sound stupider, like more basic. How can we boil this down?
If you guys need any help with sounding stupid, you can just call me up. I'll be glad to.
The use of this symbolic logic, I read a lot of analytic papers and at the University of Texas that abused it. You know, it's a way of making your paper look more rigorous than it is. And so you get abuses on both sides of the divide. You know, on the continental side, you get obscurity for the sake of obscurity. And then when you accuse them of obscurity, they say, well, Hegel was obscure. Well, Hegel was legitimately, you know, and it's too bad he was, or maybe he had to be because he was thinking on the edge. You can argue about that, but there's a sense in which he was legitimately obscure. But just because you're writing obscurely doesn't mean that you've suddenly risen up to the level of Hegel. And it's a very popular way of writing, and there's a lot of literature out there, especially with the influence of Lacan and Derrida. There's a lot of people who write in a way to seem sophisticated, and they're saying very, very trite things, and it's dressed up in a way that seems sophisticated, this obscurity. And then on the analytic side, you get people trying to be very precise. They're not trying to make the sort of grand pronouncements you would get in the continental literature, but in doing so, they're saying almost nothing, right? It's like adding one each time with each paper, you know. With this paper, I will add one. This paper is the successor of the last analytical paper on this topic.
It's weird hearing you talk about that because I was thinking back to the incompleteness theorem. And if your paper is complex enough to try and say anything that's of substance, then you're necessarily going to get some bullshit in there.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Whereas if you try and approach it from a more logical and rigorous perspective and avoid any inconsistencies, then you're just going to end up with tautology, yeah. Just 1 = 1 sort of thing.
So that was the frustration writing in both Texas and University of Michigan, where I went before, were very analytic philosophy departments, ultimately, despite having occasional faculty members that were not. And it was really an expectation that when you're writing a paper, you have to write it very analytically, which means it's really hard to actually say anything that you feel was worth saying.
Yeah.
Because it would just take a whole book to build up. Yeah. You know, it's just like Russell is taking so long to get to 1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah.
What's the line? In order to bake a cake from scratch, you have to first create the universe. Something like that.
Very good.
That's why we like guys like Robert Solomon or Hubert Dreyfus, that they're writing about these, or Nelson Goodman or Arthur Danto. They're writing about these difficult things, but writing in very analytic ways, in ways that don't hurt our brains to read. It's not just a matter of being rigorous and systematic, but a good analytic philosopher in the way we are taught to write is writing in a way that will be soothing to read.
And Solomon, I mean, I don't think anyone would say he's analytic. Even in his style of writing, he's just a damn good writer. He's clear. You know, yeah, if you equate analytic writing and clear writing, he's clear and he's unpretentious. And it's not a matter of just dumbing down things. Again, Hegel has an excuse. If you're thinking on the edge and you're making a tremendous original contribution, then you have an excuse to get bullshitty and obscure, trying to say things which really can't be said, strictly speaking, you know, as Wittgenstein would say. But if you're writing about Hegel and you want to sound like Hegel, what's the fucking point? You know, I'll just read Hegel.
I ultimately believe that Hegel's obscurity is a stylistic flaw.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Nietzsche's writing like a horse's ass, as entertaining as it is, but like, you know, don't write like Nietzsche now. Even if you are coming up with original shit, give more thought to your presentation than your oomph.
I don't know. I think Nietzsche is...
He's not systematic.
I don't think of him as unclear, but yeah, he's not systematic. Nietzsche would be a blogger today.
So now we've name dropped all over the fucking place. But that's because we've pretty much finished Russell, and we're trying to put, you know, what at least is good about Russell is that, again, he's clear. He's mellifluous to read. Now, I remembered the first time I brought up Russell to you in the context of this podcast, Wes, you really dismissed him as just sucky in the same way that you don't like the new atheists. Yes, I didn't want to say the name.
I think I was specifically thinking of his History of Philosophy, which is sucky.
And okay.
I'm not alone in that. He doesn't understand Kant very well. I mean, because the guy, he didn't take Kant seriously, and he didn't take a lot of people seriously. And so you get these sort of straw man versions of them. And that's what I think is unfortunate. For this type of stuff, this is interesting and it's serious work. But then I think in some ways he didn't take the History of Philosophy as seriously as he should have.
I was looking at his, so I have a little book of his, The Problems of Philosophy, which is...
I've read that as well.
Yes, it's ostensibly an introduction to philosophy, but it's really an introduction to his philosophy.
Right.
It's just like, isn't my philosophy just common sense when you get down to it? Come on now. Come on.
Yeah.
I don't remember where I was reading this. I think it was something about Quine and how he was on a train with Russell. And this is like the only time he really had a good conversation with Russell. And he asked him about John Locke. He said, like, you know, why is John Locke so freaking famous? You know, he's clearly inferior to Hume and his others, but he's had a greater impact in England. And Russell said something to the effect of, Locke discovered common sense and only the English have had it since then. which just, you know, gives a good picture of what is good and what is terribly wrong about Russell. I think even in just this little introduction and talking about logic on our blog, we've seen a little bit of firestorm about bitching about analytic philosophy and how soulless it is. But to me, it's fundamentally about just speaking clearly.
Yeah, it's clarity of thought.
Yeah, even if you're not putting things in symbolic form, you still have the idea of cogent arguments using appropriate rules in the back of your mind and are trying to clarify that for the reader and not do something more crazy and artistic where the reader has to then sort of reconstruct the logical arguments themselves. You're trying to actually put them out there so they can be understood and you will be convincing, which is what analytic philosophy, I think, is all about, whether it's writing about ethics or about Hegel or about whatever. It's just, it's still analytic philosophy.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be dry or, I mean, I think you can be artful as well. You just have to be good at it. I think you could be writing in a, hell, you could even be writing a personal essay and you could have quite a literary style and still be, you know, if it's a philosophical, if there's some philosophical part of the essay, you could avoid being obscurantist for the sake of seeming deep. I think there's room for a middle ground where someone doesn't think of themselves as an analytic philosopher necessarily or an analytic writer. But their goal is to communicate the reader, right? And that can involve metaphor, that can involve lots of things, not just logic and argument. Metaphor is, especially as your ideas get more and more difficult, those sorts of tools become more and more important.
Yeah, this is actually going to be a great line of thought to continue with our next dude. But before I announce who that is, Josh, do you have any other sort of closing of your overall impression of Russell, overall thought about philosophy of math, what you've advanced from reading this?
Man, who cares? It's just numbers, for God's sake. It's just 1, 2, 3. Get over it. Let's go do something with it. You know, that was my philosophy to begin with. And
you're a mathematical nihilist.
Yeah, math is only important insofar as it is important to you.
He's a mathematical pragmatist, not a nihilist. There's a great difference.
I know some people who claim to be mathematical atheists because they don't see any. Well, 1 + 1 = 2. It just magically becomes 2? What is that?
It's bullshit.
Yeah.
Well, I can see a line to pursue with that. Like, well, why do you need these fucking forms of infinity? I believe in the old-timey 1, 2, 3, many. And now we've just advanced beyond that. And so you can count very high, but you still can't count to infinity. So there's no fucking infinity, man. You know, the plebeian take on this. So I guess I buy the fact that you can't axiomatize basic addition without having infinity in there. But I don't ultimately see the point. I guess I am more of a Platonist or a definitionist or something of insisting that we define numbers in terms of sets of objects in the real world and them being I don't know. There's something that seems phony about that to me.
Going all the way back to the beginning of the book, Russell explicitly says that the most obvious and easy things in mathematics are not the ones that come at the beginning. So he basically says mathematics is really obvious and very intuitive. And what we're going to be exploring through the text is this kind of hard and unintuitive and weird realm of the basis of mathematics and trying to give a rigorous definition for it.
I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I mean, ultimately, and this is for something for a future episode, you want to think about different theories of what numbers are, and you know, you have all the competing schools about them. So that's something that still interests me. You said it seemed kind of artificial to try and reduce this to similarity between sets and or classes, and it does seem that way. It's odd in a way, but also fascinating, so.
Yeah, I guess I just want to reiterate my recommendation. I think this is a great introduction to symbolic logic, to higher math. Not that I feel like I have a lot of points of comparison. There's probably many more recent things, but you could do worse, especially if you're a philosophy completist, like apparently I am in wanting to do this. So I don't think it was a bad choice. But next time we're going to read Friedrich Schleiermacher's.
That's easy for you to say.
No, it's a Friedrich Schleiermacher's.
Oh, maybe not so easy.
On Religion: Speeches to Its Cultural Despisers, originally published in 1799, updated in 1831 with his own commentary. I thought this was an interesting point of comparison because he's a preacher. He gives freaking sermons. Mm. So he's really trying to be clear and connected, but he's also in the heart of the Romantic movement. And so he's hardly an analytic philosopher in this way. And he is a great representative, maybe the father of liberal theology, liberal Christianity. He's a pluralist, the defender of the kind of religion that maybe somebody who believes in science might still be okay with. A religion that will pass the Kantian muster, and a good counter, perhaps, to the new atheists that we will read some episodes from now. Wes, thanks for joining us this time.
You're welcome.
Josh, thank you so much. It was
thank you guys for having me on.
Yeah, thanks, Josh.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Hopefully you'll see some of Josh's writing on our blog, partiallyexaminedlife.com. We'll follow up on some of the issues raised here. We'll provide links to some more text by Russell and other folks, Girdle. So check it out. Hey, while you are subscribing to our podcast on iTunes, why don't you go onto the iTunes store and give us a nice rating? You can also follow us through our email list. You can join our Facebook group and see some updates that way. You can follow us on Twitter and get updates whenever we post new things to the blog, new episodes, see what the upcoming things are. We want to hear back from you. You can get on the blog and discuss things. You can send us emails through that. Why don't you send some episodes of this to your friends and family, for instance? You know, if you are a person who studies philosophy, why would anybody want to study philosophy? I think our podcast is a good way of convincing people that you're not insane.
Well, having a podcast about the philosophy of why numbers and where numbers come okay. from maybe might not be the best way to do that, but...
Point taken.
Don't let them listen to this episode.
Start with episode one. And hey, if you feel like you are a specialist in some area, like Indian philosophy, say, or linguistics, or you don't think the stuff we've done in continental or analytic in particular has been sufficiently knowledgeable, then please contact me. We're always looking for guests on the show to schedule out into the future. So good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Again.